those of you who have taken my Personnel Economics 1 course will find similarities in the topics and even more similarities in the style of my teaching. Unexpectedly, I much appreciate so many people have turned out to take Personnel 2 after having the traumatic experience of taking Personnel 1. I really greatly appreciate your custom. So even though it's not the easiest course in your curriculum, and this one's going to be worse. Now, so, but if you are up for a slightly challenging course in terms of maths, in exchange, well, what I think is highly interesting, and, well, you probably know me, I worked with real firms, with practitioners, so I know not only the theoretical side of things, but also the practical side of things. And one of the good things that, one of the few good things that people tell about me is that my lectures are full of practical examples. Practical examples not of the level, oh, there's this paragraph such and such of the law on such and such that tells you I'm not a lawyer, right? So practical examples in the sense that, well, this theoretical model that we are working through now actually has some practical meaning because people do end up having to make decisions and do end up in situations that are described by this model. So actually listen in because it's not as scholastic and irrelevant as you might think. Personnel economics is actually one of the least scholastic and theoretical courses in this entire economics curriculum. So Personnel Economics 2, as the title suggests, it's not Personnel Economics 1, it's Personnel Economics 2, so it's kind of sequel of Personnel Economics 1. What are the differences between Personnel Economics 1 and Personnel Economics 2, right? So in Personnel Economics 1, we looked at the envelopment of, we look at the unfolding of the employment relationship, right? So we said, let us watch the firm and the worker throughout the entire evolution, throughout the entire development of the employment relationship between them, right? So we started from the pre-employment relationship. We started from the application and selection stages, and we ended with talking about employee turnover, right? So those of you who attended my course, Personnel 1, you may have a vague and distant recollection of what we were talking about. The difference between Personnel Economics 1 and Personnel Economics 2 is that we have a narrow focus here. In Personnel Economics 2, we're going to be talking only, well, only in inverted commas, about motivation, right? So it's a narrower focus. We're not going to talk about employment relationship throughout its different stages. We are going to talk about motivation, right? But motivation is a very wide topic, it's a very big topic, right? So, and so big and so wide that one course is not really sufficient to cover all the different aspects of motivation, but we will try. Motivation, as the lecture materials helpfully show, motivation is not only about, well, let's motivate people monetarily, right? So let's offer monetary incentives and hope that we can align people's inner motivation to do things with the external requirements and rules that govern just one aspect, just one channel through which people derive satisfaction from their employment. Money is important. I think I would probably not lecture at this university had I not been paid fairly well. Money is important, but money is not the entire story. In Personnel Economics 1, we assumed that money was the entire story. In Personnel Economics 1, we talked exclusively about monetary incentives. We talked about incentive schemes with target, without target, incentive schemes that were piece rate, incentive schemes that were bonus-based, incentive schemes for individuals, incentive schemes for teams, lots and lots of incentive schemes, right? In this course, we are going to talk about monetary incentives, but we're not going to be talking about monetary incentives quite as much, right? We're going to go beyond monetary motivation and talk about other non-monetary or not directly monetary aspects of motivation, right? So motivation beyond monetary incentives is about formal policies HR practices, and less formal psychological contract-based relationships within the workplace that encourage employees to deliver good performance and discourage them from delivering bad performance. Now, what would be the formal policies that encourage good performance? What would be the formal policy that encourage good performance, right? Well, monetary incentives is a formal policy in the sense that it's written in the employment contract or in some addition to employment contract saying that if you fulfill such and such performance target, you get such and such money. That's a formal policy that encourages good performance. What would be the formal policy that discourages bad performance? Well, the formal policy that discourages bad performance is this famous or infamous three strokes rule. Have you heard of this three strokes rule in HR practice? Anybody? Three strokes rule? No. Well, lucky you. Now, in the United States, it comes from the United. It comes from America, like many good things. I think it's also popular in Britain, right? So this three strokes rule, what does stroke mean? The stroke means this, you know, so Dreistrichregel, I think, in German, right? So you make offense once, it's a strich, it's a stroke in your file somewhere, right? You make an offense twice, it's a second strich, it's a second stroke in your case. But the third stroke means that you're out. Right, so that's, if you formalize this policy, then you get a formal policy that discourages bad performance, right? So if you fail personnel economics 2 exam once, that's one stroke, it's okay. If you fail it twice, that's two strokes. What happens then? Then you're out, right? So watch out, and let's hope that you will pass personnel economics 2 exams without the invocation of the three strokes rule. But to me, and if for the purposes of this course, more interesting is not formal policies, but the informal relationships around the employment, right? So what would be informal practices? What would be informal relationships that encourage good performance and discourage bad performance? Have you heard of peer effects? Anybody? Peer effects? Have you heard about peer pressure or public pressure? No? Peer effects? Peer effects is the social pressure from outside that pressurizes us towards certain behaviors and discourages other sorts of behaviors, right? So, I mean, I don't see a lot of people walking naked on the street, right? So not only because it's a bit chilly outside, but also it's kind of socially frowned upon, right? So, I mean, I'm not sure whether it's a criminal offense, but even if it wasn't a criminal offense, you wouldn't see a lot of people walking naked on the street because it's kind of weird, right? So why is it weird? It's because this kind of social norms that are not encouraging this kind of behavior, right? So it's not nice to defecate in the open. I mean, do excuse me, the physiology, right? But it's actually a big, huge problem in India. It is a public health issue, right? In India, big, huge country, defecation in the open is, I mean, you can laugh about it, but it's a big problem, you know? If people shit on the streets, you're gonna have a lot of unhealthy germs and bacteria in water supply, and, you know, you're gonna have diseases, life expectancy suffers, people get, well, it's unhealthy, right? So you can criminalize this, but then you have to enforce. And it's kind of, imagine yourself, right? So a much more efficient institution would be some kind of informal rules, which dictate that, look, you have to find an appropriate place to relieve yourself. And if you do not follow this informal, unwritten rule, then, you know, a lot of fingers will be pointed at you, and rightly so. Okay, so now that's kind of big picture of the difference between personnel economics 1 and 2. So it's motivation defined much more broadly and not going well beyond monetary incentives. This brief outline of the course is organized around a big question, and the big question is, how do you motivate people, right? You practice monetary incentives. We studied it in Personal Economics 1. We're also going to revisit this a little bit in Personal Economics 2. For example, we have this management of incentives. We have lots of lectures on monetary incentives that I mentioned earlier. In this course, we're going to have a lecture on efficiency wage, which is a monetary incentive practice. And we're also going to talk about career concerns and intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation, comparing and delineating the monetary from non-monetary incentives, thinking about the interaction effects between the two. It's going to be very, very interesting. So you do motivate people with money, but then sometimes when you motivate people with money, you can have some secondary effects that you do not necessarily fully account for in your naive models of monetary incentives. Now, but of course, a seemingly more direct way to motivate people is simply regulate everything, right? So, I mean, you can impose peer pressure and really, you know, apply social pressure to prevent people defecating in the open. That's peer effects. You can prohibit this practice and criminalize it. That would be imposing formal authority. You can introduce fines for defecating in the open. That would be monetary incentives, right? Or still, you can show some leadership in saying, look, I am Mahatma Gandhi, or I am such and such rock star or Bollywood actor, and look, guys, it's really not cool to shit in the open, so let's not do that. That's leadership. There are lots of ways of motivating people, and we're going to touch upon these ways. So understanding the interactions between people at work and their performance consequences, right? So we're going to have lectures on teams and lectures on peer effects. So somewhere, yes. We're going to have a lecture on team incentives. That's kind of just to connect Personal Economics 1 and Personal Economics 2 courses. We're going to have a lecture on a recognition. That's one of my favorite lectures. Recognition is a great way of motivating people to do good things, right? So, I mean, you can apply peer pressure to prevent bad behavior, but you can also exemplify and encourage good behavior by providing positive feedback. You know, like, thanks for not shitting on the street today, right? That would be kind of positive feedback, and sometimes it works better than negative feedback. That's the outline of the course. You can find specific course topics on this slide. We're going to try to stick to the schedule to the largest extent possible, but changes are not impossible. I'm not saying that they're likely, I'm saying that changes are not impossible. People get sick, including myself. People get some sudden changes in plans. We'll try to avoid sudden changes in plans, but as an active researcher, I travel to conferences and worldwide to foster my research collaborations. I have a project here and a project there, and sometimes I have to be off. We will either make up or I will record a lecture and place it on the Ilias website. But yeah, so that's the sort of schedule. Changes are possible, but we'll try to avoid them. There will be lectures and tutorials, just like in Personal Economics 1. The difference is, I will be the one doing both lectures and tutorials. So Personal Economics 1, I had a teaching assistant. Personal Economics 2, I don't have a teaching assistant, so you're stuck with me both in lectures and tutorials. You'll see which tutorials we will have and when. Well, not chronologically when, but in terms of the sequence of the course topics, right? So if you want to know the tutorial schedule, you have to look it up, right? I think it's available on Zeus. No? Did you register for the course via Zeus? Okay, so Zeus is good, but I don't use Zeus. I use Ilias. The communications platform between me and you is not Zeus, it's Ilias. So if there is an announcement to be made about the course, like, for example, a cancellation or shift in the lecture time, or a cancellation or change of the time of the tutorial, this announcement should come through Ilias. That's why it's very important to register for the course and to access, to make sure that you registered for the course on Ilias, right? Because you want to stay on top of things. By the way, Have you been able to look up, have you been able to find the course webpage in Ilias? Okay, great. In Ilias, we have lecture slides now. Later on, as the course develops, we're going to have tutorial slides, also in Ilias, right? So I don't have a special, or at least I don't care of having a special webpage for tutorials, since I'm doing both lectures and tutorials. I will just dump everything on the Ilias webpage of the course. You have lecture slides and tutorial slides there. Given the relatively small size of this course, I think we won't have a huge communication problem. Course materials. The good news is that there's no textbook for the course. Just like, personal economics, there was a textbook for the course, but I don't think anybody bought it because it's so expensive, right? But the textbook for personal economics, one course was Peter Kuhn, Personal Economics, 2018, I think. For this course, Personnel 2, there's no textbook. The course materials are these lecture slides. So that's one important course material. Another part of the what you have to read for the course, what you have to study for the course, are the academic articles, right? So I'm going to provide links to academic articles in scientific journals. And some of them, not all, but some of them come with an asterisk next to it, right? So what does this asterisk signify? This asterisk signifies that these articles, the content of these articles is exam relevant. So I hope I will not have to deal with the most popular questions that students ask. Is this chapter or is this part exam relevant? The answer is by default, yes, if the reading is marked with an asterisk. Okay. I will upload a couple of past exam papers for you to have an idea of how Personnel Economics 2 exam looks like. I will upload it in due course. If I do not do that, if I forget to do that by, let's say, 1st of June, will someone send me an email, please, reminding me to do that? And then I will upload it. What it takes to do well in the course, I think those who took my Personnel 1, you already kind of know what it takes to do well in this course. But those who haven't taken my Personnel 1, so think about this as course prerequisites, but also, and more importantly perhaps, think about this as a kind of, as friendly guidelines, as friendly advice from a more experienced colleague, because I was a student. I can look fondly, mostly, at my student experience from the vantage points of many years since I was a student and many years of working in academia. So let me tell you, you know, I really know a thing or two about studying, university, teaching, right? So I'm fairly smart. Most of the times I know what I'm talking about and I'm super modest. Yeah, so listen in. To do well in this course, you have to be good at microeconomics and econometrics at an undergraduate level. If you have not studied econometrics, well, tough luck. You're going to have to. Or withdraw from the course. I'm not saying that you have to be experts in econometrics. What I am saying is that you have to be able to interpret empirical results. You have to be able to interpret results of regression analysis. I'm not saying that we should be very, I'm not saying that you should be experts in econometrics. We're not going to be deriving 24th formulation of the central limit theorem for non-normally distributed fifth moment. So that's an interesting exercise, but that's not going to be part of this course. I'm talking about a reasonable knowledge of undergraduate econometrics that can be expected as a default from a senior bachelor student like yourself. You are semester 6 students, right? When you are in the 6th semester, then you are pretty senior bachelor students, right? You've taken econometrics, you've taken statistics. Have you taken my Intro to Org Econ course? You should be able to understand empirical output. And you should be able to understand the output from the regression results. So the absolute requirement for this course is that you should make sure that you can make sense of the regression output. If you're not very comfortable with this part of your education right now, That's not the end of story. That's not the showstopper. We are at the beginning of the course, right? You should become experts in interpreting regression results at the end of the course, when the exam comes. And in the meantime, if you're not comfortable with that, you should become comfortable with that through learning, through asking questions, through actively participating in the course. Now, another requirement that I'd like to talk about explicitly is the ability to do high school maths. This not the, I'm not asking you to do exercises in set theory and topology, right? It's high school maths, just a moment. It's high school maths, and I expect that you can work with derivatives, integrals, and you can solve basic optimization problems. I expect you to know what a first-order condition is, what a second-order condition is, what a binding constraint is in Kuhn-Tucker framework, what a non-binding constraint in Kuhn-Tucker framework is. I expect you to know the Lagrangian optimization. There exists a question bank. I've made a question bank, but I have to revise it because there have been some news. You see, there are advantages and disadvantages with question banks. I'm usually sympathetic to the idea of publishing question banks, but I have two reservations. First, if I publish questions bank of the course, right, then I have less freedom when it comes to preparing examination assignment. And understand that every year of teaching this course, I have to prepare two versions of exam because there are two examination attempts, right? So if I publish a questions bank, I have to come up with questions that are not exactly like those in the questions bank. And that's a constraint on my action, which I may or may not accept. Which brings me to the second point. The second point is, I do not want to overshare with you, not in some kind of emotional conversational way, that too, of course, but I do not want to, do you know what oversharing is? Right? It's when people who are not very closely acquainted with each other talk about intensely personal things with each other, right? So that's called oversharing. So that's not going to be, we're not going to overshare. I don't want to overshare materials with you. Why? Because I want you to actually come to my course. If I supply everything, right, if there are videos, if there are lecture materials, if there's question banks, if there are past exam papers, my experience shows that people stop coming to my lectures. And in my professional life, few things have been more discouraging than coming at 8 o'clock in the morning to lecture to insects flying through the room. Okay? So let's make a psychological contract. If you come to my lectures, if you talk to me, if you participate in the course, if you show interest, I will share. It's a two-way street. But if you treat me like a TikTok video, I will not share. Deal? You know, a professor at a good university, you know, working with firms, working with people. I am an asset, you know, I'm a smart guy. You have to listen to me to learn something. And if you don't come to my lectures, I've been teaching executive education to managers in Singapore. They came to my lectures. Who are you not to come to my lectures? Participate, and you will really learn something, I promise. Treat my course as TikTok, and it will be very transactional. Am I making myself clear? Do you understand what transactional means? What I mean with transactional? Well, there is relational and transactional. What is relational? Relational is when people walk the extra mile, when people really care about each other. Right? So students care about professor by paying attention to the course. Professor cares about students by sharing extra materials, by really helping them learn, by answering their questions, by making himself available for consultations. So that's relational. Transactional is rules-based and nothing extra, right? So the rule is there is an exam and there is another exam and there are 15 lectures in this course. any contact, any help, any consultation from outside the limits defined by the lecture are not going to be made available, right? Any sharing of material that is not absolutely necessary for the purposes of the course as outlined in the course description will not be done. That's transactional. It's not exactly like this, you know. I want to be friendly, but I don't want to be friends with you, right? We're different generations and we are different, you know, we have power distance. I want to be friendly with you, I don't want to be friends with you. But I do want to be friendly with you, meaning that I want to be relational. I want to see your interest and participation, and I want to reciprocate by giving you lots more. Okay, that's relational. But if you stop coming to my lectures, if you do not talk to me, if you don't participate in the course, if you don't care about the course, I won't care about you beyond the limits specified in course descriptions. You understand? That's transactional. You deal with your relatives, with your family, with your friends in a very relational way. You deal with your employer in a more transactional way. That's the difference. Relational versus transactional is one of the leitmotifs of the course, right? So it's good that we talked about it now. Okay, now I mentioned maths, I mentioned microeconomics, I mentioned econometrics. Personnel Economics 1. So some of you took my Personnel 1 course, others didn't take my Personnel 1 course. And the obvious question is, are people who have not taken my Personnel 1 course, are these people at some sort of disadvantage relative to the people who did take my course? However, life is unfair, but we want to be fair as possible. And the good thing about transactional versus relational is that transactional tries to enforce kind of minimum standards of fairness. So in the spirit of enforcing the minimum standards of fairness, let me assure you that the grading of this course, the standards of exam, the kind of questions that will be asked on the exam, they do not draw on any material learned in Personnel 1. So in terms of the exam relevant knowledge, you're not at a disadvantage, in a sense that the questions to be asked on Personnel 2 exam for this course will be the questions covered in Personnel 2 lectures. There will not be questions covered in Personnel 1 lectures. So in that sense, you're not at a disadvantage. However, if you want to get a fuller picture, if you want to have more understanding of Personnel Economics, you are highly recommended to visit my Personnel Economics 1 course webpage on Ilias and download the lecture slides. I will not upload Personnel Economics 1 lecture slides on Personnel 2. I don't want to spoon feed you, right? So if you're interested, go ahead and find them. There are video recordings of my Personnel 1 lectures. There are lecture slides of my Personnel 1 lectures. Check them out. It's really good stuff. But once again, just to make it crystal clear, and we're being video recorded, no question related to Personnel 1 will be asked on the exam Personnel 2. Just to make it super clear. What it takes to do well in this course? Participation. You have to participate. The word education, what is the root of the word education? Is duc. What does duc mean? What does it tell you? Ducare in Latin? Do you know duke, like Herzog in German, and in English is duke? What does it mean? Who were the dukes in Middle Ages? Nobles? But okay, there were dukes and there were counts and there were princes. Who were dukes? You see, education, duke. Education, duke, sounds similar. Who were dukes? No. Teachers. No. Thanks for trying. No. So dukes were people who led the armies. Ducare, or education, is a process of leading. So you take person figuratively by the hand and you lead them. That's education. You lead people. That's education. Education. Do you understand? It's not training, right? It's not going through a computer game on YouTube. Look, I press this button there and I get so many points there. No. It's leading people through an intellectual journey. That's education. And I won't settle for anything else. Another, so who comes from Wirtschaftspädagogik here? Who comes? Ah, okay, so we have two people, Wirtschaftspädagogik. So let me engage with you, madam. So you do Wirtschaftspädagogik, right? Yes. What is pedagogic? What is pedagogue? Or from which language does this word originate? So pedagogue comes from ancient Greek. What does it mean in ancient Greek? Ped, what does it mean in ancient Greek? It means child. Pedos in Greek means child. Hence the word pedophilia, which is sick obsession with children, right? So pedos is child. Now, this pedagogy means, so who was pedagogue in ancient Greece? A pedagogue was actually a slave whose job was to lead the children of his master, just lead them and educate them and sort of train them on in the ways of life, all right? So hence pedagogy. That's what you study, leading children, right? I don't know if you actually want to work in pedagogy rather than, where do you want to work? Do you want to work in school? So that's leading children, interacting with them, engaging with them, right? I want to be useful, I want to be friendly, I want to be helpful. By default, I do not want to be strictly transactional, but I may be if you feel like it. Education is a process, it's a two-way street, we have to talk. If we don't talk, it's boring. And we may as well try to make the most of the time that we have. So you have to participate. You participate, you do well on the exam. You don't participate, you don't do well on the exam. You get your 3.7 and that's it. So you have to participate. And it's a choice course, right? You're not obliged to take this course, or are you? It's a choice course, right? So first of all, thanks for making this choice. Second of all, if you don't like it, the door is open. But if you do like it, and if you are prepared to participate in the course, let's participate in the course and we'll make the most of the time. We'll learn a lot and we'll have great results on the exam. Please ask questions. Uni Constance, 8 years I've been working here. It's a great place. As an employer, Uni Constance is probably the best employer I've ever had. So I'm very, you know, with or without camera on, it's a great place to work. One thing about Uni Constance students is that they don't ask questions. I don't know why. Okay, so, but why do you ask friends rather than professors? Yeah, actually, I am kind of like this. I really don't like to sort of show, I like to show off in front of people, but I don't like to show off in a negative way in front of people. You know, when I ask questions, I don't want to signal my lack of understanding or, you know, whatever. And I don't have big hopes that this course will miraculously change things. Do you know a guy named Socrates, ancient Greek philosopher? Did he actually exist? Nobody knows. Actually, the figure of Jesus Christ takes inspiration from Socrates a little bit, right? So those who those who believe in Jesus, they believe in Jesus as the Son of God. Those who look at Christianity as a cultural and historic tradition, they can see a lot of parallels, right? So that's a different and very interesting story. So what I wanted to say about Socrates, have you read Plato? Check out Plato, dialogues, any dialogues. He wrote a lot of, check out, for example, Phaedro, or check out his writings on politics, right? So I haven't reread my Plato since undergrad, I have to check him out as well. But what I noticed is, you know, what we know about the teachings of Socrates, they come through the dialogues of Plato. And in those dialogues, they are really, they really make sure you read at least one of those. Socrates comes across as an idiot. Well, but okay, idiot is actually a kind of, is actually an offensive term, right? So when you call someone idiot, it's not nice. But the word idiot is actually not, is not necessarily an offensive word. I mean, I'm not going to walk around calling people idiots, right? So that's not what's going to happen. But the word idiot comes from ancient Greece as well. What does idio in ancient Greek means? Like the, in the word idiosyncratic. Do you know the word idiosyncratic? Do you know the word idiomatic? So, but I'm more interested in the idio part. What does idio mean? Idio means own, your own, means special, means peculiar. I am an idiot in a sense that I have my own style of teaching. I'm not saying that my own style, I'm not saying that my style of teaching is idiotic in the vulgar sense of the word, right? So, and I think it's pretty smart. But I am an idiot because I am peculiar. I am on my own, right? I don't want to fit some standards, requirements, etc. Do you understand, right? So I'm an idiot in the sense that idio, idios is own. And Socrates comes across as an idiot, not because he's stupid, but because he's original and peculiar and special. So what is so special about Socrates? When some smart guy, it's typically guys, you know, in this misogynistic society of ancient Greece, right? When a smart man says something very clever and everybody says, oh, wow, how wonderful. Socrates says, excuse me, sir, please do excuse my lack of education, right? I'm so stupid. But, you know, could you please elaborate on what you meant? And, you know, the smart man condescendingly looks at the Socrates, and he didn't dress very well, right? So he looks at the Socrates, look, man, you really have to go and do some schooling, right? You really have to go and learn some. Clearly what I meant is that. And then Socrates says, oh, but sir, but you mentioned this. How does it... So the method of Socrates is to ask, quote unquote, stupid questions. And with this questioning, discover the truth. That's Socratic method. It's a big thing. This is how Western intellectual tradition has formed. Asking questions. You have to ask questions. There are no stupid questions, right? And you really have to suppress the fear. Another Greek word, agoraphobia. What is agoraphobia? What is agoraphobia? Agoraphobia is a fear of being in the open. That's what agoraphobia is. Agora, ancient Greek word for open place. Do you know what agora in Athens was? The place where there was a market and then there were some public presentations, etc., right? So agoraphobic people are people who would really like to sit somewhere in the farther corner like this. That's agoraphobic. You should not be agoraphobic. You should come straight. You should sit up, you should ask questions, make yourself present. Where do you want to work? You don't know. Time to know. Your education is coming too, right? Where do you want to work? In a school. Great. Michel Bachelet was, the former president was a school teacher, right? So, do you want to work at school? Sit up. Be center of attention. Ask questions. Participate. Officially, we're being recorded. I promise and swear that there are no stupid questions in this course. When you hesitate whether I should or shouldn't ask a question and say, oh, but I might not because my question might be stupid. There are no stupid questions in this course, right? So let your own thinking about how stupid this question is not be in the way of your communicating with the purposes of learning. Be Socrates. Socrates was, according to Plato, the smartest man he ever knew. And yet, Socrates comes across as an idiot, not only as a peculiar and special man, in the original sense of the word idiot, but actually Socrates doesn't come across in the beginning, he doesn't come across as a very intelligent man. And later on, it transpires that he's super intelligent, and those ostentatious people who thought they were geniuses, they actually made a logically inconsistent argument. Be Socrates. Now, and if you really don't feel like asking questions in the open, you can ask your questions to me in private. The best time to do that is to stay after the lecture and ask your questions. But sometimes you may not have time. For example, today I have next lecture starting at 10, so I may not have time. Do you know where I sit? So I sit in room F249. You are very welcome to come to see me. I'm not on campus every week, but I try to be here every other week. So for example, this week is my teaching week, and I am on campus every day, Monday to Thursday including. In 2 weeks' time is my teaching week again, and we meet again, and I'm on campus. So if you have questions, if you feel like talking, come and talk to me. Come in groups, come individually, come however you like, come as you are. And if I particularly enjoy the discussion, I will offer you my very own coffee. But do come, do ask questions, do make the most of the course. Let's not make it TikTok, okay? I really hate this. I feel that I'm losing touch with the so-called Generation Z, whatever it means. I'm really losing touch with you guys. I want to reconnect. And I think it's for our own mutual good. I like to talk with interesting people, exchange ideas. You can benefit from talking to knowledgeable people, right? And I'm one of those. So come check me out. Come talk. Come ask questions. Try not to do things that you're not really interested in. I mean, it goes without saying, right? It's a choice course. You can choose it, and you can but you can choose not to. But if you're here, it means you're kind of mildly interested in HR issues. Let us continue to develop this interest in HR issues. Who wants to work in HR as a career? Why are you interested in HR? You know, it's stereotypically more kind of human touch and... Which is right. HR has to be human touch. HR, because HR is human, right? It should not be so technocratic as many other functions are, right? But in this course, there's going to be some maths, you know? So I'm sure you'll navigate. I'm sure you'll manage because, as I said, it's not very advanced maths. And it's not maths for maths' sake. It's maths for the sake of deeper understanding of what's going on. Okay, so I understand your current reason for HR because it's not mathematical, but career-wise, why would you be interested in HR? Right, so it's education, you know, leading people. No, it's nice. I like HR, you know. Most of what I do is actually what I like to do. And that's a great advantage. Most of the people do little what they like to do. Most of what I do, I actually like to do. What I don't like to do is teaching at 8 o'clock in the morning. I also don't like to teach kind of in the empty room without any interaction, without any human eyes looking at me, right? So, but I hope we can avoid it in this course. You know what can really propel you in HR? You know what can really make your career in HR? I mean, you can do, as you said, you can do a lot in HR. You can do mentoring, coaching, you can do education, you can do career planning, you can do compensation and benefits, you can do technical HR, you can do strategic HR. What is the emerging area in HR that can really propel you to HR vice president very quickly? What is it? No. There are lots of psychologists. And HR is full of psychologists by education. A lot of Wirtschaftspädagogik people go to HR. Did you know that? As Winston Churchill said, Winston Churchill? This guy, you know, right? Very controversial political figure of mid-20th century. He said, success is going from failure to failure with a smile on your face. Right? So you should try. You should try. Sometimes you fail. But that's too general. I was asking about activity. What kind of activity, what kind of specialism in HR will make you vice president in no time? Absolutely. But specialism in HR, you're talking about personal characteristic, which is very important. Indeed, you have to speak. You have to show off. You have to stand your ground. Okay. I don't want to make too much of a theatrical pause. Now, the activity, the specialism in HR that really will propel you to a position of importance is HR analytics. HR analytics, ever heard of HR analytics? No? HR analytics is to use data analysis, basically econometrics on steroids, to advise HR decisions. So how are HR decisions made? HR decisions are made by intuition. Oh, everybody's so intuitive. Oh, everybody's so human touchy. Oh, everybody's so sympathetic. Oh, HR is traditionally less mathematical, right? So let's kind of, true. But because HR is less mathematical, data people have an advantage there. So if everybody is psychology, sociology, right? If everybody is kind of into humanities, into human touch, then you have to compete with hundreds of other people who are into human touch, right? HR analytics, data analysis with application to HR is really one of the, I would even say the hottest area in HR. So you have SAP that do a lot of HR analytics. Well, I wish you'd come to my bachelor seminar in HR analytics. We do some HR analytics there. It's the application of data analysis to inform HR decisions. What kind of HR decisions should we inform? Okay, how much money to pay to people? How to construct an incentive scheme? How to organize a policy of hiring? Right? How to organize a policy involving the process of turnover, right? Right now, people use intuition and legal guidance in designing these policies, right? But actually, a more scientific way is to use data analysis, which is now enabled by machine learning and artificial intelligence. So think about, check this out. HR analytics is a really, really hot topic. My observations informed by LinkedIn and Xing and watching the career progress of people I know in the HR profession suggests that HR analytics is really, really hot. And if you find yourself in a big company with lots of people, meaning lots of observations and big data, you can really make a career based on HR analytics. Okay, so, but that's just a side remark. Okay, so that's what it takes to do well in the course. There is one exam at the end of the course, 90-minute exam at the end of the course, and past exams will be uploaded. So it's just like in Personnel 1, right? So, and like in Organizational Economics, Introduction to Organizational Economics. End of the course, we have exam. Exam is written, 90 minutes, and you're welcome to ask questions about the exam throughout the course and at the revision lecture at the very end of the course. So one thing I want to tell you, that's this kind of standard part of all my lectures. Maybe you've seen it in Personnel 1. But I'm going to say this again. The exam is written, not oral. You know who will be grading the exam? Any idea? Any vague idea who will be grading the exam? I can't read this doctor's handwriting. I've been working in academia for ages. I can't read this handwriting. Don't even begin writing this way, okay? If your handwriting is as bad as mine, use block letters. If I cannot read what you've written, I cannot grade it, do you understand? And if I cannot grade it, I can't give you points. And if I can't give you points, we're going to have boring meeting at 8 o'clock on Friday at the revision session of the exam, right? Do you want that? I don't think so. So please communicate yourselves clearly. Not only orally, but also in writing. Otherwise, it's just not readable. This is an example. So one example. Can you actually read it? No, I cannot. This is almost embarrassing. There is a university in America, Kutztown University. It's a small university. I didn't know about it before I Googled it. So this Kutztown University, what I don't know the demography of the students there, but they prepared these guidelines called classroom behaviors. You see this behavior without you, it's in American English. I use behavior with OU, right? I'm not chauvinistic, I'm just poking fun, you know? So the etiquette and class behavior. I do not think that this needs to be said to the very respectable University of Konstanz students, right? I don't think that it needs to be. But just in case you feel like play on your phone, do work for other classes, cheat or plagiarize or use your mobile phone, just be aware that Kutztown University does not approve of these behaviors. I don't like it when people use their mobile devices in my lectures. It's not productive because the people don't learn, right? And it's offensive. I don't have the legal powers. I don't have the transactional powers to stop this behavior. I will question the hell out of you, right? So don't do that. Drinks are totally in order, totally fine. Please don't come with breakfast or lunches to the room, to the lecture room, right? So you're munching up all the time during the lecture is not good. It's not good. Needless to say, don't cheat or plagiarize, but Uni Konstanz students do not cheat or plagiarize. I'm fairly certain they don't do that. So think about this as an etiquette, right? So as I said, it's almost embarrassing. I'm sure that you are broadly aware of the etiquette in the classroom, but just in case, you know, I use it as a standard slide in all my classes just to make sure that we're on the same page when it comes to understanding of the classroom behaviors. That brings me to the next lecture. Are there any questions? Great question, thanks for asking it. I have to check my tutorial schedule for personnel too. My understanding was that I have both lectures and tutorials on the same week, but if my tutorials are actually, or at least some of my tutorials are on the weeks that I'm not here, that we'll do it in Zoom. Okay, well, thanks for coming. I'll see you tomorrow.